Graphic Audio. A movie in your mind.
Graphic Audio presents Legends of the First Empire, Book 2, The Age of Swords, Part 1, by Michael J. Sullivan. Narrated by Terence Aselford, with performances by Colleen Delaney, Jessica Lauren Ball, Eric Messner, Christopher Walker, Kimberly Gilbert, Nora Ashrati, Amanda Forstrom, Thomas Keegan, Yasmin Toison, Chris Stinson, Bradley Smith, Richard Rowan, Lise Bruneau, Todd Schofield, Terence Aselford, Jacob Yeh, Peter Holdway, Scott McCormick, Matthew Schley, Nanette Savard, Tia Shearer, Joe Mallon, Zeke Alton, Chris Gennebach, Matthew Ward, Michael John Casey, Christopher Sheeran, Michael Glenn, Evan Casey, David Jordan, Matthew Bassett, Rose Elizabeth Supan, Mort Shelby, Danny Gavigan, Ken Jackson, Jonathan Foyer, Laura C. Harris, and Barbara Pinellini. Legends of the First Empire, Book 2, The Age of Swords, Part 1.
Most people believe the first battle of the Great War occurred at Granford in the early spring. But the first attack actually took place on a summer's day in Dal Ren, the Book of Bryn.
Are we safe?
Magda was the oldest tree in the forest, massive and majestic. Standing before her was like staring at an ocean or mountain. Each made Persephone feel small.
That was too simple.
Is there more that needs to be done to protect my people from the fray?
Persephone waited for an answer. The broken tree limb would have killed her if it had landed a few inches closer. Broken branches suspended in the forest canopy were called widowmakers. Since Persephone had already lost her husband, the dead wood lying beside her must have been an overachiever.
What's that about?
Suri, the young mystic with the white wolf Minna by her side, glanced at the fallen branch.
Just the wind, I think. Feels like a storm is coming.
Once before, when Persephone had sought the great tree's counsel, Magda's advice had saved her people. Now she was back, seeking answers again. Months had passed since her last visit, and life at Dal Ren had returned to a comfortable routine. The destruction created by the battle between two Miralith had been cleaned up, but Persephone knew that hadn't ended the conflict. Questions remained. Questions no human or Frey could answer. And yet...
It's not a good sign when Magda starts a conversation by trying to crush me.
Something wrong?
The Frey woman, Arion, was still learning their language and stood beside Suri and Minna, watching with great interest. She wore the green hat Padira had crocheted for her. Its whimsical quality made the Miralith appear more approachable, less divine, more human. Arion had come along to witness the oracle in action, although Persephone had expected more talk and less action. Suri looked up at the tree.
Don't know.
Suri, what's Magda saying?
That was how it was supposed to work. Persephone posed questions to the tree, and the mystic revealed the answer after listening to the rustling of leaves and branches. But Arion was right to ask if something was wrong. Suri had a perplexed look on her face. More than merely puzzled, she looked concerned.
Not sure!
Why not? Is she talking in riddles or just ignoring you?
Suri's face twisted in frustration.
Oh, she's talking all right, but so fast I can't tell what she's saying. Just babbling, really. Never seen her like this. She keeps repeating, run, run fast, run far, they're after you.
They? Who? Is she talking to us? Is that the answer to my questions?
Suri shook her head, short hair whipping across the tattoos on her forehead.
Nope. She was yelling before you said anything. I don't think she heard you. I'm not even sure how Magda knows the word run. I mean, seriously, how does a tree know what that is?
Are you saying the tree is hysterical?
Scared to death. I know mice who have made more sense. She's not even using words now, just making noises.
Suri's brows jumped up, her face tensing, eyes squinting, mouth pulling tight.
What? It's never good when a tree screams.
Tall grass slapped Persephone's legs, her dress whipping and snapping. Ripped from their branches, the oak's leaves flew thick as snow in a blizzard. Under Magda's dense canopy, Persephone couldn't see the sky, but the wind was stronger than ever. Stepping out, she discovered that what had been clear blue just moments before had turned a tumultuous gray. Dark clouds bubbled one upon another, turning midday into twilight. A strange green light cast everything in an eerie, unnatural hue.
What's happening?
Tree is panicking.
Maybe we should return to the doll, yes?
Minna drew closer to Suri, nearly knocking the girl down. The mystic knelt to comfort her wolf.
Not right, is it, Minna?
Looking more serious, Arion gave up speaking runic and returned to her native tongue.
We need to...
Minna bolted down the slope, Suri right beside her. Persephone staggered. Blinded by the afterimage that left a bright splotchy band across her vision, she vainly tried to blink it away. Her nostrils filled with wood smoke, and she felt the heat of a blaze. Magda was on fire. Arion lay on the ground at the base of the tree, both hands raised, shielding herself.
Ogenya Pushti!
The fire engulfing the old oak vanished. In its place was a terrible hiss and smoke swirling in a malevolent wind. Magda was cleaved in two, split down the center. A horrible blackened gash with bright red edges flared with each gust of wind. The ancient and wondrous mother of trees had taken a mortal blow from the gods.
We need to run.
What? Why?
Arion grabbed her by the wrist and pulled.
No! Now!
Persephone's scalp tingled as Arion dragged her down the hill and out of the glade toward the thick shadow of the crescent forest. She could see Suri and Minna ahead of them, sprinting. Lightning struck the ground somewhere behind them. Two more bolts rent the air close enough for Persephone to feel their heat. Running together, she and Arion followed Suri and Minna as they plunged headlong into the forest through thickets, brambles, and thorns. Gasping for air, Persephone glanced back. A series of scorch marks smoldered in a direct line between the oak and where they stood. They all jumped as the sound exploded directly overhead. Like the old oak, the trees above caught fire. One huge branch fell like a giant torch.
Need shelter!
Roll nearby! This way!
The girl dashed deeper into the wood, Minna bounding at her side. Persephone might not understand the language of trees, but she understood anguish. The wood shrieked. The forest cried out as the wind stripped away summer gowns of green. Then a loud, all-encompassing roar rose from everywhere at once. At first, Persephone thought it might be sheets of rain, but the noise was much too loud, far too violent. Balls of ice tore through leaves and branches. Fist-sized missiles assailed the canopy, ricocheting off limbs and trunks. Two huge chunks of ice struck her back, glancing blows, but they carried the sting of a switch and the force of a punch. She kept her arms up to protect her head. In the lead, Suri stopped at the foot of a sheer rocky cliff and slapped the face of it with her palm. Persephone saw a section of the stone's face open, revealing a little room neatly carved out of rock. The mystic leapt inside, followed closely by the wolf. From the doorway, Suri swung her arms in huge circles, waving the other women to safety. The chieftain of Dalren and the Miraleaf crossed the threshold together, crouching to avoid hitting their heads. Once in, Persephone turned to witness the destruction. Another bolt of lightning split the air, and for an instant, a dazzling array of translucent shades of green illuminated the leaves, a light brighter than the sun. A nearby cottonwood caught fire. Sheared in half, the tree fell in a rain of sparks and flame. The wind fanned the fire started by the strikes, spreading an inferno, ice and fire, wind and debris. Persephone stared, lost somewhere between horror and awe. Suri slapped the keystone and the door closed. Outside, the lightning cracks and hammering hail continued, but from a safe, muffled distance. Realizing they'd escaped without significant injury, the three exchanged the stunned looks of survivors. Relief washed over Persephone, until she noticed they weren't alone. Gifford would never win a foot race. Although he came to this realization late in life, everyone else knew it the day he was born. His left leg lacked feeling, couldn't support his weight, and dragged. His back wasn't much better. Severely twisted, it forced his hips in one direction and his shoulders in another. Most people pitied Gifford, and a few even despised him. He never understood either. Roan was the exception. What everyone else saw as hopeless, she took as a challenge. The two were out in front of Gifford's roundhouse, and Roan was lashing the wood and tin contraption to his left leg, tightening its leather straps. She knelt in the grass before him, wearing her work apron, a smudge of charcoal on the side of her nose. Her dark brown hair was pulled back in a short ponytail, so high on her head that it looked like a rooster's crest. Dozens of cuts from working with sharp metal marred her clever little hands. Gifford wanted to hold them, kiss the wounds, and take the pain away. He tried taking her hand once, and it hadn't gone well. She'd pulled away, her eyes widened with fear. Roan had an aversion to being touched. Gifford had known that. He'd simply forgotten himself. Her reaction wasn't limited to him. She couldn't suffer anyone's touch. Yanking hard on the ankle strap, Roan nodded with a firm, determined expression.
That should do it.
She rose and dusted her clean hands symbolically.
Ready?
Gifford answered by pulling himself up with the aid of his crafting table. The device on his leg, constructed from wooden sticks and metal hinges, sounded like the opening of a tiny door.
Do you have your weight on it? Try. See if it holds.
For Gifford, any attempt to support himself with his left leg was akin to leaning on water, but he'd gladly fall on his face for her. Perhaps he could manage a roll and make her grin. If he'd been born with two stout legs, strong and agile, he'd dance and twirl like a fool to amuse her. It might even make her laugh, something she rarely did. In her mind, she was still a slave, less than nothing. Gifford longed for Roan to see herself the way he did, but damaged as he was, he made a poor mirror, casting back a broken image. Gifford shifted some weight to his lame leg. He didn't fall. A strain tugged on the straps, wrapped around his thigh and calf, but his leg held. His mouth dropped open, his eyes widened, and Roan actually did smile.
Huh?
Whoa! By Maui, what an amazing sight!
Gifford couldn't help grinning back. He was standing straight, or as straight as his gnarled back allowed. Using what seemed like magic armor fashioned by Roan, Gifford was winning an impossible battle.
Take a step!
Her hands were clenched in fists of excitement. Gifford shifted weight back to his right side and lifted his left leg, swinging it forward. He took a step the way normal people did a million times, and that's when the brace collapsed.
Oh no!
Gifford fell, barely missing the newly glazed cups. His cheek and ear slammed into the hardened dirt, jarring his head. But his elbow, hand, and hip took the bulk of the punishment. To Roan, it must have looked painful, but Gifford knew how to fall. He'd been doing it his entire life.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Roan fell to her knees and bent over him as he rolled to his side. Her grin was gone, the world less bright.
I'm okay, no problem. I missed the cups.
The metal failed.
She struggled to hold back tears as her injured hands ran over the brace.
The tin just isn't strong enough. I'm so sorry.
It held for a while. Keep at it. You'll make it work. I know you will.
There's an added force when you're walking. I should have accounted for the additional weight when your other leg is raised.
She slapped the side of her head several times.
I should have realized that. I should have. How can I not think of that?
He instinctively grabbed her wrist to prevent additional blows.
Don't do that, please.
Roan jerked away in terror.
Oh!
They exchanged embarrassed looks, mirroring each other. Gifford forced a smile, not one of his best, but the best he could manage, and picked up the conversation.
Roan, you can't know everything when doing something new. It'll be better next time.
She shifted her focus. She wasn't looking at anything in particular. She was thinking. Sometimes Roan thought so intently that he could almost hear it. She blinked and emerged from the stupor. Walking over to Gifford's crafting table, she picked up one of his cups. The awkward moment vanished as if it had never happened.
This design is new, isn't it? Do you think it could hold its shape at a much larger size if we could find a way to...
You're a genius, Roan. Has anyone told you that?
Gifford's smile turned genuine. She nodded, her little rooster crest whipping.
You have
Because it's true.
She looked embarrassed again, the way she always did when he complimented her, the way she looked when anyone said something nice, a familiar unease. Her eyes shifted back to the brace.
I need something stronger. I can't make it out of stone. I can't make it out of wood.
I wouldn't suggest clay, though I would have made you a beautiful hinge.
He was pushing his luck at trying to be amusing.
I know you would.
Roan wasn't one for jokes. Much of humor arose from the unexpected or preposterous, like making a hinge out of clay. But her mind didn't work that way. To Roan, nothing was too absurd and no idea too crazy.
I'll just have to think of some way to strengthen the metal. There's always a better way. That's what Padira says, and she's always right.
Roan had good cause to think so highly of Padira's opinion. The oldest resident of Dal Ren, Padira had seen it all. She also had no trouble expressing her thoughts, regardless of whether people wanted to hear her opinion or not. For reasons beyond understanding, Padira had always been particularly harsh with Gifford. As Roan struggled with the buckle, the wind gusted and blew his cloths from the crafting table. Two cups fell over. Thick, voluminous clouds rolled in, blotting out the blue and blanketing the sun. Around the Dal, people urgently trotted toward their homes.
Get the washing! Get the washing!
Viv Baker and her daughter tended to their laundry. The Killian boys raced after chickens, and Bergen rushed to shut down his new batch of beer.
Perfectly blessed day, just a minute ago.
He peered up at the sky as if it could hear him. Another gust made Gifford's entire set of cups topple, rolling on their sides and making half circles on the tabletop. He had been having a productive day before Roan had stopped by, but she was always a welcome distraction.
We need to get your pottery inside!
Roan redoubled her effort to remove the brace, but was having trouble with one of the buckles.
Oh, made it too tight!
The wind grew stronger, whipping the banners on the lodge. The fire braziers near the well struggled to stay lit, but lost their battle. Both snuffed out.
That's not good. Only time they've blown out was when the lodge's roof came off.
The wind's assault on the thatch of his little house caused dirt and grass to pelt his face and arms. Frustrated with the buckle, Roan reached into one of her pockets and pulled out another of her inventions. Two knives, bound in leather so they could both cut at once. She used them to release the brace's straps, freeing him.
There! Now we can...
The clap of thunder was so loud that Gifford felt it pass through him. Giant logs supporting the structure exploded, and thatch ignited.
Did you see that?
Another lightning bolt struck on the other side of the lodge.
Whoa!
He and Roan stared in shock as a third and then a fourth bolt hit the log building. Cobb, the pig wrangler and part-time gate guard, was the first to react.
Bergen! Bring gourds to the lodge!
He and Bergen ran toward the well, picking up water gourds on their way. Another bolt of lightning exploded the well's windlass into a cloud of splinters, and both of them dived for the ground. More lightning bolts rained. Each strike was followed by fire and smoke. All around Roan and Gifford, people ran to their homes. The Galantians, Frey warriors who had been welcomed to the Dal when exiled, rushed out of their tents and stared up at the sky. They looked just as frightened as everyone else, which was as disturbing as the cataclysmic storm. Until recently, the Frey had been thought to be gods. Gelston the shepherd ran past. As he made his way between the woodpile and a patch of near-ripe beans in the Killian's garden, lightning struck again. Gifford didn't see much, just a snaking, blinding brilliance. When his sight returned, Gelston was on the ground, his hair on fire. Bergen rushed to the man's side and doused his head.
Roan, we need to get to the storage pit. Right now!
He grabbed his crutch and pushed himself up.
Roan! Gifford!
Wraith and Malcolm hurried toward them. Wraith still carried two swords, the broken copper one slung on his back and the intricately decorated Frey blade hanging naked from his belt. Malcolm held a spear in both hands.
Do you know where Persephone is?
No, but we need to get to the pit!
I'll spread the word! Malcolm, help them!
The ex-slave moved to Gifford's side, put his shoulder under the potter's arm, and practically carried him to the big storage pit, while Roan followed close behind. With the first harvest still more than a month away, the pit was nearly empty. Lined with mud bricks, the hole retained the smell of musty vegetables, grain, and straw. Other members of the Dal were already there. The Bakers huddled with their daughter and two boys against the back wall, their eyes wide. Engleton and Farmer Whedon peered out the open door at the violence of the storm. Bryn, the doll's newly appointed keeper of ways, was there as well.
Have you seen my parents? They're not here.
No.
Gifford could only imagine the lightning strikes that accompanied the rolls of thunder they were hearing. Being down in the pit, he couldn't see the yard, just a small square of sky.
I need to find them.
Bryn bolted toward the exit, springing like a fawn. Unlike the crippled Potter, Bryn could win a foot race, and she was easily the fastest person in the doll. The girl regularly won every sprint during the summer rule festivals, but Gifford had anticipated her dash and caught her wrist.
Don't go back out.
Let me go!
It's too dangerous!
I don't care!
Bryn yanked hard, so hard she fell, but Gifford still hung on.
Let me go!
Gifford's legs, even his good one, were mostly useless, but reliance on his arms and hands had turned them into vices. Bryn had no possibility of breaking free. Autumn, Fig, the Killians, and Tressa stumbled through the door, all of them exhausted and out of breath. Heath Coswell and Bergen came along just after. They dragged Gelston, who remained unconscious. His hair was mostly gone, the scalp red and black. Bergen was covered in dirt and grass.
The lodge is burning. It looks like a harvest moon bonfire.
Has anyone seen my parents?
Not I.
No, I haven't seen them.
As if the wind and lightning weren't enough, hail began to fall. Apple-sized chunks of ice clattered, leaving craters in the turf on impact. More people raced into the shelter of the pit, running with arms and baskets over their heads. Bryn watched each come in, always looking for but not finding the faces she sought. Finally, Nifrin and his Galantians charged in with shields protecting their heads. Moya, Cobb, and Habit were with them. Bryn resumed struggling against Gifford's unrelenting grip.
Let me go!
You can't leave! Your house is burning! There's nothing left for...
Outside, a roar grew like the angry growl of a colossal beast. Everyone stared out the doorway as the sky turned darker still and the wind blew with even more force. Roundhouses were ripped apart. First the thatch, then wood beams tore free, and log walls disappeared, sucked into the air. Even mud brick foundations were scattered. A whirlwind cloud of dirt and debris consumed everything outside the storage pit.
Close the door!
The giant Grigor started to haul the door shut just as Wraith arrived.
Hey!
Wraith pushed in through the closing door and scanned the crowd.
Has anyone seen Persephone?
She's not here. Went to the forest.
Are you sure?
Suri, Arion, and Seth went to talk to Magda.
That old oak is on top of a hill in an open glade.
Gifford thought Wraith looked like he might throw up. There had been rumors that the Durian was in love with Dol Ren's chieftain, but a lot of recent gossip had turned out to be untrue. Seeing Wraith's face, however, removed any uncertainty. If Roan were lost somewhere outside, Gifford would have looked the same way. Everyone sat or knelt, fearfully listening to the roaring storm. With the door closed and guarded by the giant, Gifford let go of Bryn, who collapsed and sobbed. All around, people quivered, staring at the ceiling, no doubt wondering if it too would be ripped away or cave in. Gifford stood beside Roan, the crowd pressing them together. He'd never been this close to her for so long. He felt her warmth and smelled charcoal, oil, and smoke, the scents he'd come to associate with Roan and all things good. If the roof collapsed and killed him, Gifford would have thanked Mari for this final kindness. The shelter was little more than a hole in the ground, but because it protected the doll's food supply, the pit was solidly built. The best materials went into its construction. The walls were dirt and stone, the ceiling braced by logs driven into the ground. Most of Gifford's work ended up in this pit. Huge clay urns held harvests of barley, wheat, and rye. Their tops were sealed with wax to keep out the mice and moisture. The enclosure also safeguarded wine, honey, oil, vegetables, and a cache of smoked meats. At this time of year, most of the urns were empty, and the pit was little more than a hole, albeit a sturdy one. Still, the ceiling shook, and the door rattled. The only bit of light entered through the narrow cracks where the door didn't precisely meet its frame. This sliver of white flickered violently.
It'll be okay.
Gifford whispered to Roan as if it were a secret he'd chosen to share with her alone. Around them, people grieved, and not just women and children. Gifford heard Cobb, Heath Coswall, Habit, and Filson the Lampmaker weeping openly as well. But Roan didn't make a sound. She wasn't like them. She wasn't like anyone, and she didn't look scared. Instead, intensity shone in her eyes. If not for the dozens of people between Roan and the exit, he had no doubt she would have opened the door. She wanted to see. Roan wanted to see everything. After what felt like hours, the clatter of hail stopped, but the rain continued to fall. The howl of the wind had faded. Even the cracks of thunder had fallen silent. Finally, the light from around the door became bright and unwavering. Nifrin opened the door and crept out. A moment later, he waved for the others to follow. Everyone squinted against the brightness of the sun, struggling to see. One of the lodge's banners lay on the ground, its ends frayed. Thatch and logs were scattered everywhere. Not a single roundhouse had survived. Branches, leaves, and broken bodies littered the yard, none of them moving. Overhead, the clouds had broken up and drifted away.
Is it over?
As if in answer, the doll's front gate trembled under a huge impact.
What is that?
The gate began to buckle. The Rawl where Suri, Minna, Arion, and Persephone sheltered was like the one under the waterfall which had provided refuge from a pack of wolves and a deadly bear named Grin months ago. Carved from natural stone, the room was about the size of a roundhouse and had strange markings near the ceiling. While the waterfall Rawl was slightly larger and square, this one was perfectly round and contained six stout pillars surrounding a gemstone the size of a storage urn. Embedded in the floor, the standing crystal gave off a green, unnatural light. Six heavy benches encircled the stone as if it were a campfire and the room used for telling ghost stories. In front of the bench farthest from the door stood what Persephone first thought were three small men. Each was less than 4 feet in height, their faces illuminated by the eerie emerald light. She might have screamed, and certainly would have recoiled, if their expressions hadn't been so clearly marked by shock and fear.
Oh! Hello. Sorry for barging in. A bit scary outside.
None of the three replied. Stocky, to the point of appearing square, with large hands, broad noses, deep-set eyes, and bushy brows, they stood as motionless as statues. They wore shirts made of metal rings, and a row of metal hats lay on the nearby bench. The reflection of the green light from their armor made them appear to glow in the dark. They were Durg. Persephone had met their kind before. She'd traveled with several caravans to Dal Tyr and the nearby port town of Vernez, where the Durg had shops. She and her late husband, Reglan, had traded with the Durg on behalf of Dal Ren, swapping antlers, hides, and pottery for bits of tin. The Durg were far less intimidating than the Frey, but even less trusting. The Durg on the left had a long white beard and a sword. The one on the right also had a sword, but his beard was gray. The fellow in the middle had no sword at all and almost no beard. A massive pickaxe was strapped to his back, and around his neck he wore a golden torque.
Is this your Rawl?
The Durg didn't answer or even look at her. Instead, the three focused on Arion with a mixture of hatred and terror.
Do you mind if we share it until the storm passes?
Still no answer. Persephone wondered if they even understood Runic. Not all Durg did. They were orthodox factions that shunned outsiders and foreign ways, including language.
I need to sit.
Arion staggered toward the benches. At her approach, two of the Durg, the ones with the beards, bolted for the door. One slapped the keystone, and it started to slide open. The moment it did, the noise outside grew deafening. Neither the voice of hail nor the roar of fire. This rumble was louder, deeper. The growl of whirling wind. Persephone had seen it before. As a girl, her father had held her high on the doll's wall to witness a god's wandering finger scratch the back of Elan. Across the distance of more than a mile, the whirling black funnel ripped up trees. Persephone had wondered what it would be like to be a rabbit or mole caught in that cataclysm. Now she knew. Outside, leaves, grass, dirt, stones, hail, branches, and whole tree trunks flew sideways, smashing into one another. From somewhere in the storm, another tree snapped in half. Persephone felt a pull, like the current of a powerful river dragging on her as air was sucked out through the opening. The white-bearded Durg felt it too, and braced himself at the threshold. He looked at the raging storm, then glanced back to Arion, trying to decide. With his beard whipping, he turned away from the door.
Close it! Close it!
The gray-bearded one clapped hand to stone again. The door rolled back into place until the roar was shut out once more.
You're doing that!
The white-bearded Durg pointed accusingly at the door while glaring at Arion. She sat on the stone bench, shaking her head wearily.
Not of my making, believe me.
I don't believe you.
Arion flexed her fingers as shock and worry creased her brow. She reached up and put a hand to the back of her head.
It's okay. It'll come back.
Suri pointed at the series of pictographs chiseled along the top of the walls.
See? The markings.
They were the same as the ones on the bandages that had prevented Arion from using magic. Arion nodded slowly. She was frowning, but looked relieved. Seeing that the three Durg were still glaring at her, she pointed to the glyphs.
Those are yours, so you know I'm not responsible for what's happening.
Persephone had never seen Durg quite like them. None of the others she'd met were dressed in metal. The traders in Vernez wore floppy wool hats of bright orange or red, and long tunics, usually dyed yellow or blue. Metal in the southern regions wasn't common, and the Durg coveted it, like sacred relics, their form of magic. They haggled stubbornly for even small bits of tin, but it was their other metals that were truly remarkable. Wondrous bronze, which could be forged into invincible weapons, and gold and silver, which shone with divine light. She wondered if these three were rulers or otherwise powerful members of Durg society. Whoever they were, it'd be a mistake not to make a good impression, or at least the best that could be made after barging in on them. She thought it was time someone did the polite thing.
I'm Persephone, chieftain of Dol Ren. This is Arion of the Frey, and this is Suri. Oh, and her wolf, Minna, who is very nice and will do you no harm.
Perhaps because they realized Arion wasn't capable of performing magic, or because Persephone had been the first to address them, the three finally appeared to notice her existence. They looked at her with no less suspicion, but far less fear. She offered the friendliest smile she could conjure.
Now then, who might you be?
They all offered one more glare at Arion before the white-bearded one spoke.
I'm Frost of Nye. This is Flood.
He clapped a hand on the shoulder of the one beside him, making the gray-bearded Durg wince. Frost pointed at the one with the pickaxe, who hadn't run for the exit.
And he is called Rain. My companions obviously weren't properly watching the door.
Us? And what were you doing?
Why was guarding the door our responsibility?
I was busy trying to remove a pebble from my boot.
Careful, it might be your brain. If you toss it away then. Well, now that I think of it, we likely wouldn't notice any difference, so go ahead.
Honored to make your acquaintance.
Persephone bowed formally, which appeared to surprise them.
Now, how did you know about our role? These are secret places, safe areas, known only to our kind.
Suri is a mystic and has lived in the Crescent Forest all her life. She led us here.
All her life? How long could that possibly be?
Suri is, well, special. She's located many Rawls, haven't you?
Suri was petting Minna's neck, oblivious to the conversation.
Suri?
What?
I was telling them that you have a knack for finding Rawls. Could you explain how you do it?
Empty places feel different from the ones filled with dirt and stone. It's fun to find the spot that opens the door. Although Minna sometimes gets bored if I take too long. Don't you, Minna?
We just came here to get away from the storm. We had no idea it was occupied. I hope you don't mind. But as you can see, the storm is...
A thought wriggled into her head, and then more than one. A whole set of puzzle pieces fell together. The suddenness of the storm, Arion telling them to run, and the trail of scorched divots left in their wake. She turned her attention to the Miralith and spoke in the Frey language.
Arion, how did you know?
The bald woman still sat, head resting in her hands.
Know what? You told us to run, and that lightning, it wasn't random. I don't know how, but it was trying to hit us, right?
Yes.
Arion rubbed her head through the knit hat she wore, her expression pained.
This was how it was in the war.
Frost seemed to be talking to his companions, but he spoke in Frey.
When the Frey attacked, we'd shelter in Rawls.
You couldn't know anything about the war. Derg don't live that long. I was young then, but I remember. You don't. You only know stories.
Frost's hand went to his sword.
Don't call me a Derg, you elf.
What did you call
me? Hold on. Maybe we should all calm down a little. I'm sure Arion meant no disrespect. The storm is too dangerous for any of us to leave, so let's make the best of it. We don't know how long we'll all be stuck in here.
Persephone moved to sit beside Arion and was unpleasantly reminded about the hail that had struck her back. She also had time to notice the many cuts along her hands and legs from the thorn bushes. Her left ear hurt as well, though she didn't know why.
You might as well sit down.
Frost and Flood looked at each other and then returned to the benches on the far side of the glowing green gem. Rain, who hadn't stopped looking at the carved symbols since they'd been pointed out, had wandered into the shadows near the back wall, head tilted up, studying the carvings.
Pardon me for asking, but if Derg, that is, if what Arion said isn't the correct way to refer to your kind, then what is? It's the only term I've ever heard.
Derg is a Frey word, meaning vile mole. How would you like it if we called you runes? That's also a Frey word. You know what that means, right? Barbarian, primitive, crude. Do you like being called that?
Persephone hadn't thought about it before. To her, to most everyone in the 10 clans, few of whom spoke Frey, rune was just a common term, a name. Now that he mentioned it, she realized it had been an insult.
So what do you call yourselves, then?
Belgr Klungrians.
Oh, really? That's... well, that is a mouthful, isn't it? And what brings you to the Crescent Forest? I don't remember your kind ever coming this far north.
The three exchanged uncomfortable looks.
That's really none of your business now, is it?
Persephone was becoming exasperated by the effort of the conversation. Even idle chit-chat seemed to provoke their ire. Outside, the noise grew softer. Only rain now. The storm was lessening. The patter became a pleasant, comforting, non-threatening sound.
Does that mean it's over?
That morning had begun so agreeably. A clear sky and a leisurely walk through the forest meant a refreshing change from the growing tension about a potential war. Prior to a few months ago, the Frey were thought to be gods, immortal. Then Wraith had killed one, throwing everything in doubt. A few weeks later, he slew Grindel, the seemingly all-powerful Frey Miralith, and all doubt had vanished. The Frey were not gods, but they were powerful. Retaliation was only a matter of time. Still, Persephone had expected an army, not lightning bolts. Suri saw Arion rubbing her temples.
Headache.
Mm-hmm.
Arion got up. Her movements sent a jolt of fear through the two bearded Derg, who briefly jumped to their feet. When Arion lay down on the floor and rested an arm over her eyes, they relaxed.
What's wrong with the elf?
Don't talk to them.
Why do you call her elf?
That is what they are to us. Nightmares.
But elf is a Frey word.
Not much sense calling them names in our language. What good is insulting someone if they don't know you're doing it?
You aren't pronouncing it right. It's Ylf, not elf.
Persephone moved to where Arion lay and knelt beside her.
The pain is bad?
Yes.
Arion used both hands to rub her eyes.
Is there...
Everyone exchanged glances with similar worried expressions.
What is that?
No one answered. The Derg were on their feet again, all three looking up. Again, dust, bits of rock, and pebbles rained down from the ceiling, glinting off the gemstone. Persephone got to her feet and approached Frost, who, along with Flood, was backing away, moving toward the door again.
During the war, did the Frey ever manage to get into these Rawls?
The two Derg looked at each other with so much concern that Persephone didn't need an answer.
How?
The stone ceiling cracked, and a large piece of rock fell, followed by a shower of dirt. Through the gap, a massive eye peered in.
The first giant I ever saw was friendly and liked to cook. The second one might have as well. I don't know. I never asked. It's hard to pose questions while screaming. The Book of Bryn.
The huge eye drew back, and a fist punched through part of the Rawl's remaining ceiling. The tawny-skinned hand was 10 times the size of a normal man's, its knuckles coarse and caked in dirt. Persephone and the others scattered as rock and dirt fell, bursting on the floor. Another blow and a great fist smashed through again, this time opening a hole large enough for an oryx to pass through. Frost and Flood were the first to the door.
Arion!
The fray was still on the floor. She'd sat up, but that was as far as she'd gotten. Two massive hands slipped through the opening, gripped the sides of the hole, and tore back the roof. Brilliant sunlight entered as the unmistakable silhouette of a giant loomed. The mountainous man crouched on his knees, digging with bare hands, his tongue poking out of his mouth in concentration. The giant thrust his craggy face into the opening. He peered in as if examining the contents of a sack. The green glow of the gemstone worsened an already terrifying visage. Narrow eyes, set beneath a precipice brow, bulged with a maniacal leer. Shadowy canyons lay to either side of a promontory nose, beneath which gaped a cavernous mouth of uneven, intermittent, tombstone-shaped teeth. The behemoth's hot breath smelled of rotted meat and strawberries. The head drew back and a hand thrust in.
Run!
Frost and Flood had already escaped with Suri and Minna close behind, but Arion never had a chance. The giant grabbed at her as she struggled to her feet. As the massive hand closed, Rain swung and planted the spiked end of his pickaxe in the giant's fist. The Colossus let go and jerked his hand back. He clutched his blood-gushing wound while looking down with snarling fury. Persephone and Rain took that moment to help Arion, and together they dived out the open door just before the giant rose and slammed his foot down on the Rawl. The ground shuddered as dirt and dust blew through the door. Outside, the trees were gone. Some uprooted, others snapped, leaving only splintered trunks. Mangled limbs, logs, branches, and leaves littered what was now a bald spot within the wood. Frost and Flood found their way toward thicker cover. Suri and Minna paused atop a toppled hickory to look back as Persephone labored to get to her feet in the tangle of branches. Unlike the others, Arion wasn't fleeing. She sat still, arms out, anger in her eyes. The giant struggled to free his foot, which had become lodged in the hole where the Rawl had been. He became frustrated as it slipped deeper despite his attempts, sinking first to the ankle, then to the shin. Finally, the ground swallowed him up to the knee. The giant's other leg was finding similar difficulty, as if the mutilated forest floor had turned into a swamp of tar. Two huge hands came down in an effort to push himself up, but there was no solid ground, and they too were sucked into the mire. Slowly, steadily, the floor of the forest pulled the giant down. He sank past his waist, then his shoulders, and as the rich, leafy soil inched up around his neck, Arion lowered her hands, and the descent stopped. Flood clapped Frost on the shoulder and pointed at Arion, and for the first time, Persephone saw them both smile.
Ah, did you see that?
Maybe there is a way back, after all.
They pushed me! They carry too!
Persephone didn't recognize the words he shouted until he cried out in Frey.
Help!
You speak my language.
Arion had taken a seat on the fallen trunk of a maple.
Yes! Yes!
Lucky you!
Arion got up and carefully stepped through the debris. Finding the hat Padira had made, she reached down and withdrew it, frowning at the dirt and leaves covering the garment.
Let me live. I yield. You win. I'll quit.
Quit what, exactly?
Arion looked up from her hat with an irritated expression, and the giant began to slip deeper, the soil now up to his chin.
Trying to kill you. I was trying to kill you. We were sent to kill you.
Arion nodded as she brushed the dirt and leaves from the hat. Then she stopped, looked up, puzzled, and glared at the giant again.
What do you mean, we?
The thick beamed brace across the gate snapped in half. Over the last few months, Gifford had seen many strange things enter through that gate. The dead body of a chieftain, and before that, his son. Three groups of Frey, two of which had held a magical battle before the lodge's steps. And Wraith, the famed god-killer. Gifford imagined he'd seen it all, but standing outside the storage pit and the wreckage left by the storm, he realized he was wrong. The front gate of Dol Ren burst open. What entered that afternoon was a sight beyond his imagination, or more accurately, it was a sight that should only exist there. Giants. A lot of them. Everyone knew they existed, just as everyone knew gods, witches, goblins, and crimbles did. Dol Ren had even played host to one. But Grigor, who accompanied the first set of Frey, turned out to be a pleasant sort. He enjoyed cooking, kept mostly to himself. These were different, angry and ferocious. They were also bigger, much bigger, wearing kilts and vests poorly stitched from the hides of numerous beasts of different species. Taller than the gate, they had to duck to pass under the parapet. Their feet were each the size of Gifford's bed, and they carried wooden mallets that looked to have been fashioned by shoving a thick branch through a hole in a tree trunk. There were 12, and they broke through the gate with bared teeth and wild eyes. Rushing in, the giants swung their mallets, smashing the already ruined piles of thatch and fractured logs. They hammered the wind-strewn rubble and crushed a goat that had survived the storm but made the mistake of not running. A few took the time to lift the thatch and peer underneath. Then one looked Gifford's way. Much of the surviving citizenry of Dol Ren was still in the pit. Those outside, like Gifford and Roan, watched as one of the giants howled with excitement, pointing directly at them. The other 11 turned, and the ground shook as the group hurried forward. Having seen what had happened to the goat, nearly everyone cried out and retreated in terror. Roan didn't. She stood her ground, watching in awe. From behind, the Frey warriors charged out of the pit, weapons drawn, too impatient to wait the few seconds for the giants to close the distance. The first to land a blow was the one called Ares, who threw two javelins. One pierced the throat of the nearest giant, which Gifford believed to be a female Bryn Mawrion, as she had breasts and a shorter beard. The other javelin caught one of the larger attackers in the eye, driving itself so deep that only the rear portion poked out of the socket. The giant staggered, then collapsed face first into the remains of the lodge, flipping a log into the air and shaking the ground so violently that Gifford had to take a step to keep his balance. Sebek, the Frey with short blonde hair and a pair of swords, ran directly into the pack of invaders. He sprinted past the first two, and Gifford couldn't understand why until he realized that the Galantian had picked out the biggest for his target. Sebek reached his prey, ran between the giant's legs, and drove a sword into the middle of each foot. The blades dislodged, but not before the giant lost his balance. Gifford staggered and nearly fell when the giant crashed to the dirt. Sebek retrieved his weapons and sprinted up the giant's stomach. He leapt across the invader's chest and stabbed both blades into his neck. Anwer was the next Galantian to land a strike. Pulling forth a loaded sling, he swung it in circles over his head and unleashed the stone. The rock staggered a medium-sized giant just as Tekchen reached him with his long, narrow blade. After severing three fingers of the giant's mallet-like hand, Tekchen stabbed the giant's chest, cutting a semicircle before withdrawing the sword. Roan took a step forward. She had that familiar single-minded curiosity in her eyes, a sort of blind fascination that was impossible for Gifford to understand. He didn't know what had caught her eye, but in a battle like this, it hardly mattered. If she wandered too far, if she tried to get ahead of Nifron, who'd taken up a position between the giants and the people of Dol Ren to act as a final bulwark, Gifford would take hold of her wrist as he'd done with Bryn. Yes, she would panic and lash out, but he'd gladly endure the pain inflicted by her reaction if it was the only way to keep her safe. He reached out, but stopped when she didn't move any farther. Roan wasn't interested in the giants. She was shifting her gaze between Anwer and Ares, staring with intensity as Anwer wound up another stone and Ares launched another javelin.
There's always a better way.
To Gifford's surprise, Grigor joined the other Galantians in the fight against his brethren. He didn't appear to care about their kinship as he raised his huge sword and hewed down a slightly larger giant with a single stroke. Vorath, the only Frey who had a beard, which he'd grown in the style of the runes, advanced with a three-spiked ball and a chain in one hand and a star-shaped mace in the other. He waded into the fray, a whirling cyclone of whipping metal. The giants appeared confused by his weapons until Vorath solved the riddle by crushing knees and then skulls.
Kardesh! Nazash!
Suddenly, the giants retreated, dragging their fallen with them. The fray didn't pursue or interfere, even when one giant strode toward the well to reclaim the body of his comrade, which was just a few yards from where Sebek stood. As the giants fled, Gifford noticed other Dahl residents who hadn't reached the storage pit but had survived the storm. Old man Matthias Hager stood near the waste holes behind what used to be the lodge, sodden with muck. Arlena and Gilroy, their three boys, and daughter Maureen were clustered around the grindstone where the mill house once stood. Arlena's face was covered in blood, but otherwise she looked fine. Many more weren't as lucky. Bodies were strewn everywhere. Feet and arms protruded from under wreckage. The battle was over, but the toll had yet to be tallied.